Want to put up like half a blackboard of review. So from last time, we talked about a massless scalar field in a non-dynamical FRW background. FRW. So this is a free quantum field theory with one scalar degree of freedom. In this action, where tau is conformal time. And this is a theory that you can solve exactly in the sense that any observable can be written in terms of classical mode functions, which obey, sorry, the same t should be squared. Which obey a differential equation. If the expansion is simple enough, like a de Sitter expansion, then that differential equation can be solved exactly. We argue that the case we're interested in is one where A of tau is a quasi de Sitter. Meaning that the equation of state is close to minus one. And then we argued physically that at late times, phi gets nearly scale invariant fluctuations. So we argued that that particles would get quantum mechanically created, leading to some field fluctuations whose two-point function looks like this. 2 pi cubed. Minus k prime, where the notation here means the star subscript means that h is evaluated at the point in the expansion history, horizon crossing, where the wave number of interest k is equal to h. The co-moving horizon length. This expression is something that's true at late times, meaning well after horizon crossing. After horizon crossing, the equation of motion for the field just reads phi dot equals zero. And so the fluctuations are frozen in with this two-point function. I said nearly scale invariant because the k dependence is not exactly 1 over k cubed. There's a little bit of scale dependence hidden in the star notation. If I'm at one value of k and then I make k a little bit bigger, then the time when horizon crossing occurs is a little bit later. And so I'm evaluating h at a different later time in the expansion history. I say nearly scale invariant because h is nearly constant in time if the space-time is quasi-de Sitter. In the exact de Sitter case, h is constant. So if you imagine that you could observe this field at late times, and make a statistical measurement of this two-point function as a function of k, that would more or less, that measurement would sort of be like a Hubble-ometer at an earlier time when the fluctuations were crossing the horizon, in the sense that the amplitude of those fluctuations is telling you the value of h, and if you can measure that as a function of k, then you're measuring h across some range of times. That's more or less what will happen in inflation, The inflationary case is a bit more complicated in that there's more than one degree of freedom. There's a scalar degree of freedom denoted zeta, and then some gravity wave degrees of freedom. We can observe the two-point functions of those fields in the CMB, that will let us sort of reconstruct the expansion history during inflation across some range of times. So I like the massless scalar in a non-dynamical FLRW spacetime because it strips away some of the baggage associated with single field slow roll inflation. But it's general enough that we can tackle the case of single field slow roll inflation by just matching the action to the non-dynamical case. So in this lecture, I'm going to talk about single field slow roll inflation. Where in a previous lecture, after some arguments, some non-trivial arguments involving gauge fixing and eliminating non-dynamical degrees of freedom, we arrived at this action. So this first line is the action for the scalar quantity zeta. It's almost the same as the action for the scalar in a non-dynamical FLRW. The interpretation is different. In the previous case, phi was a scalar field with dimensions of mass. And here the field zeta is a dimensionless field, which is part of the metric. The action is nearly the same. The only difference is that this factor here is no longer a squared, but is something more complicated. And then there's an action, an independent action for the gravity waves. Which is the same as the previous case, except for a few extra indices and an overall normalization, which is a little different. This is all in a slow roll background. Meaning that we're assuming that the parameters epsilon and eta are, the slow roll parameters are much less than one. I'm just going to put up for, in order to refer for reference in a later calculation, some slow roll ology type results that I had on the board at one point. Some of these I derived and some of them I didn't. But they can be derived by taking whatever quantity appears on the left-hand side, relating it to local derivatives of the potential, and then expressing that result in terms of H and the slow roll parameters. So now I'm going to consider each piece of this action and talk about its physics, starting with the gravitational waves. I'll start with the, I'll do the gravitational wave first. Um, So let me remind you that the object gamma ij has 2 degrees of freedom. So the it's a 3 by 3 matrix, which is symmetric, so that reduces the number of degrees of freedom to 6, traceless, reducing it to 5. And then there's this gauge condition, which I'll write in Fourier space, which is 3 more constraints, reducing the number of degrees of freedom to 2. So I'm going to introduce a little notation for that. So if you take, if I choose coordinates so that the wave number k is in the z direction, then I can always write gamma ij. I'm working in Fourier space, so for each Fourier mode k, I choose coordinates in the z direction, and then I can write gamma ij of k as a sum of two basis tensors. So more generally, for any k, not necessarily in the z direction, I'll define basis tensors. So this tensor, the basis tensors, I'll denote with epsilon. Epsilon ij 1 and 2. So more generally, for any k, I'll define basis tensors. So that which are orthogonal in this sense. Where here the index s goes from 1 to 2. In addition to satisfying the conditions epsilon ij ai equals 0, traceless, symmetric. And then finally this gauge condition that says that if I contract the basis tensor with the wave number, I get 0. So this is just some notation that will sort of allow me to treat each Fourier mode of the field as two scalars. For each k, I'll write I'll write gamma ij as a k-dependent linear combination of basis tensors, where these quantities H sub s of k will behave like scalar fields in the action. So in terms of those fields HS, the gravitational wave action is. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have had a 1/2 here. This was like a typo in my notes. I was sort of confused about a factor of two. If I'm using basis tensors with this normalization, then when I contract with itself, I should get 1/2 because I get 2 1/2 squareds. Anyway, that's why the m Planck squared over 8 in the Mukunov-Sasaki action turns into m Planck squared over 16 here. That's just a normalization convention in defining these quantities HS. Okay. So then I can write the Mukunov-Sasaki action like this. That follows by plugging this equation expressing gamma ij in terms of HS into the original Mukunov-Sasaki action. And so in this form, you can see now it really looks almost exactly like the Bessel scalar in the non-dynamical FRW. Like each HS looks just like one of those phi fields. The only difference is the normalization in front. So it's the same as the scalar in a non-dynamical. FRW. If I change the normalization, if I defined phi to be m Planck over square root 8, HS. Then it looks the same. And so then I can read off the late time two-point function from our previous result. Let me just remind you that these fields H sub s are dimensionless, whereas in the non-dynamical case, phi had dimensions of mass. So there needs to be some different normalization with units of mass. Okay, so then the late time two-point function for the H fields. So that's just to write out the change of normalization, that would be 8 over m Planck squared times the two-point function of a canonically normalized scalar times this delta function, which is 8 over m Planck squared times h star squared over 2k cubed. So we learned from this expression that inflation naturally activates or produces fluctuations in gravitational wave degrees of freedom of the metric. This should be S prime, whose characteristic size is h squared over m Planck squared, where h is the Hubble parameter during inflation. I'll write down the observational constraints systematically in a bit. But let me just comment for now that this is something that's measurable in the CMB. Even though the CMB isn't a direct measurement of gravitational waves, putting these perturbations into the initial conditions does turn out to source CMB fluctuations with a characteristic scale dependence, especially in CMB polarization. This is something that would be amazing to detect, and that may be something that will happen in the future. But right now, we just have an upper limit, which is roughly, on the order of 10 to the minus 10. I'll write it down later, more precisely later after introducing a little more notation. So that observational constraint has a really clean interpretation. It says that the Hubble parameter during inflation can be no larger than around 10 to the minus 5 M Planck, or a number around 10 to the 13 GeV. Okay, so there's a standard notation which is to define it's almost the same thing that I wrote down in the previous line. It's just to pull out the 1 over k cubed and a factor of 2 pi squared, which is just a convention. Where this quantity now is dimensionless and is called the dimensionless gravity wave power spectrum. So pulling out those factors you'll usually see our previous result written this way. No, this is the way that I wrote it on problem 2 in the problem set. Let me remind you that h star squared. Let me remind you that this quantity depends weakly on k through h star. To quantify that, I'm gonna compute one more thing before moving on to the scalar part of the action, and that is the what's called the spectral index or tilt. This is really a function of k measured over some range of wave numbers that are observable in the CMB today. But observers usually kind of compress that down to two numbers. Amplitude, say at some reference value of k, and a k derivative that encodes the amount of k dependence, denoted nt and defined to be the derivative of log delta h squared with respect to log k. Let me comment that second and higher derivatives, so this will turn out to be a first order quantity in the slow roll parameters, minus 2 epsilon. Second and higher derivatives are higher order in slow roll parameters. And are predicted to be unobservably small in single field slow roll inflation, which is why it's sort of motivated to compress this whole function of k into two numbers. So this is a calculation we can do. We have an expression for delta h squared. When we differentiate with respect to log k, we'll trade that for a time derivative, and then we can use our slow roll ology to compute the time derivative. So first let me write it as plugging in this expression in the numerator. Let me write this as 2 times the derivative of log h star for 2 log k. I'm actually going to sort of go on a tangent for a few lines of algebra and write down a rule for differentiating any quantity x, such as h, with respect to log k. In a situation where the k dependence of x is arising solely through evaluating x at horizon crossing. So say when x star depends on k as via the horizon crossing relation. Okay. Write that as dx. First I'll just substitute k equals ah. That's the horizon condition relation. I'm going to then use the chain rule to trade the log ah derivative for a time derivative. Since all of our previous like slow roll ology results were expressed in terms of time derivatives. I'll write that time derivative. So the derivative of log a with respect to time is h by definition of h. And then the derivative of log h with respect to time is, I guess I don't really need this. So that is minus epsilon h. An identity that I wrote down up here. The identity h dot equals minus epsilon h squared. Let me write approximately here because I'm using the slow roll approximation in this step. And then because epsilon is assumed to be much less than 1, I can just write the result as 1 over h times dx dt. I did this separately because I'll need this calculation shortly for a different choice of x. Applied over here to, in the case where x is equal to h, I get a 1 over h times the derivative of log h with respect to time. By the same slow roll ology identity that I used before, that's minus 2 epsilon. Single field slow roll inflation predicts, I remind you that that epsilon is always positive since it's defined to be the square of something. And single field slow roll inflation predicts that the spectral index of the gravitational wave fluctuations, if they're large enough to detect, will be negative, meaning that this function will be a decreasing function of k. Physically, that happens because h has to be a decreasing function of time during inflation, because the inflaton is rolling downhill, not uphill. Next, I'll talk about the scalars. Moving on to the scalar fluctuations, zeta. I have this action. Now it looks just like our previous case of a scalar field zeta in a non-dynamical FRW background, except that this factor, this multiplicative factor, is not a squared, but something a little different. I can think of this as a non-dynamical as a scalar, as a massless scalar in a fake expansion history. In the fake expansion history. This is one way of reading off the answer from our previous results. Let me define z of tau to be phi dot times a over h. If I pretend that the expansion history was z of tau instead of a of tau, then I would match this action. That lets me read off the answer, but I want to just pause for a moment to be careful with notation. If I have the real expansion history a of tau and the fake expansion history z of tau, then there's now two notions of Hubble expansion rate H. I'll just introduce a notation to distinguish them. I'll temporarily write H sub A for the real Hubble and H sub Z for the Hubble and the fake expansion history. Then the late time two-point function. A way of writing it, which is correct but not super useful just yet, would be to write it as h sub z squared over 2k cubed. Two pi cubed to three minus. To finish the calculation, I just want to express the quantity h sub z back in terms of the original expansion history. The next thing I'll do is compute h sub z in the slow roll approximation. First, I'll write I'll start with Z before. Moving on to H sub Z. So far I haven't actually used the slow roll approximation anywhere. The Mukunov-Sasaki action does not assume that the expansion history is slow roll, or this expression for z. If I use the slow roll to express phi dot in terms of epsilon and h via the first equation on this blackboard, then I can write this as 2 epsilon to the 1/2 times m Planck times a of tau. If I do my slow roll ology for h sub z, that's a definition. That's these derivatives. Decided to write this as a 1 over z times the time derivative of log z. The 1 over z I write this way. Minus 1. For the tau derivative of log z, let me write that as half the tau derivative of log epsilon plus the tau derivative of log a. I'm plugging in this expression for z. And then the next line, I'll leave the first factor alone. And then for this tau derivative, I'll use equation 3 from my background equations of motion to write the result as 1 half. I'll write it without the 1 half. Ah. And then this piece is h. Okay. Then this term is small compared to, is slow roll suppressed compared to the second term. So I can write the result this way. Oh yeah, I guess I should have put h sub a's here. So h a over 2 epsilon to the 1 half. Okay. One sort of important comment here is that so horizon crossing occurs when when k is equal to ah, meaning h sub a. You can see from these expressions that a times h sub a is the same thing as z times h sub z. So there's only one notion of horizon crossing. The horizon crossing just happens to occur at the same time in both the real and the fake expansion history. And so the notation for horizon crossing is unambiguous. I don't need to define two versions of that notation. Something that I implicitly assumed here, if they were different, then this would have needed to be the horizon crossing in the Z expansion history. Okay. So now going back to this two-point function. My goal was just to express H sub Z back in terms of the real expansion history. I'll plug this in to write the result as a squared 4 epsilon and 1 squared k cubed star. Okay. That's the end of the calculation, but I'll write it in terms of, as in the gravity case, this is usually expressed in slightly different notation. The dimensionless quantity delta zeta squared is defined by pulling out 2 pi squared over k cubed with the momentum conserving delta function. This is called the scalar power spectrum and is a dimensionless quantity. In that notation, and I've also gotten rid of the temporary notation h sub a and just gone back to writing h. The scalar power spectrum can be written this way. We see that the size of the fluctuations And these fluctuations are really what source like the CMB fluctuations and like all of the gravitational structure in cosmology. Their amplitude is very well constrained, but it's a little harder to interpret than in the gravitational wave case, because rather than being h squared over m Planck squared, there's this factor of epsilon. There's a very strong observational constraint on h squared over epsilon, but it doesn't really independently constrain the two parameters. There's another, as in the gravitational wave case, the next thing that you might calculate is the scale dependence of these fluctuations. For reasons of time, I'll just say what answer you get. We have all the equations on the board. So I'll comment that there's a minus one here, which is just historical. For some reason, for the scalars, the spectral index is defined with this extra minus one. Let me put it on this side. One historical. This is defined to be one plus the derivative of log delta zeta squared over d log k. It turns out to be one minus epsilon plus two eta. This is the only observational result where the slow roll parameter eta appears. Since I'm about to talk about the observations, let me say I'll put up our previous results. So the tensor scalar index was minus two epsilon, and it was defined as d log squared d log k. And then I left space for the amplitude of the gravitational wave or tensor perturbations. Since I'm introducing all the observational notation, let me say that those are usually the usual convention is to parameterize the amplitude of the scalars as this quantity delta zeta. For the gravitational waves, what's usually quoted is what's called the tensor-to-scalar ratio R, which is just defined to be the gravitational wave amplitude relative to the scalar amplitude. If you take our previous expression for the gravitational wave amplitude and divide it by our expression for the scalar amplitude, then you end up with 16 epsilon here. So these are our these are like our theory results. Next, I want to just state the observational constraints on each of these parameters. There are four parameters here with predictions from single field slow roll inflation. Observational results are so the amplitude of the scalars is like super well constrained. It's constrained to about 1%. It's a number of order 10, a few times 10 to the minus 9, meaning that if I take the square root, the characteristic size of the scalar perturbations is of order a few times 10 to the minus 5. That's why in an early lecture I stated that the CMB was isothermal to roughly a few parts in 10 to the 5. This number is setting the size relative to the sky average CMB temperature of the initial fluctuations. So the fluctuations in our universe start out at 10 to the minus 5 in the initial conditions, or a few times 10 to the minus 5, and then grow gravitationally to be order 1 today. The quantity n sub s, which is defined with this extra 1 so that ns equals 1 would correspond to the scale invariant case. Here's the current combined constraints from a bunch of different cosmological data sets, but mostly driven by the CMB. The observation of ns being different from 1 is relatively recent. I think this crossed 3 sigma in around 2006 and is now up to around 8 sigma. Next for the gravitational waves. Currently we don't see them. We just have an upper limit. This upper limit has it's the 95% upper limit. This upper limit has gotten a lot better in the last few years, and there's still room for a lot of improvement. Like I would guess that this may improve by an order of magnitude in the next 5 to 10 years, which could potentially lead to a detection. That would be really exciting. And then finally for NT, there's just no constraint because until we detect a non-zero background of gravitational waves, we won't have any observational constraints on their scale dependence. In the last 10 minutes, I want to just try to interpret these theory results a bit in light of these observations. I'm going to start with the NS constraint. This measurement shows that the slow roll parameters are not zero. It doesn't tell you how the deviation from ns equals 1 gets divided up, so to speak, between the epsilon term and the eta term. You might imagine, I'm going to draw two pictures. One possibility is that epsilon is very small, say much smaller than eta. Then this observation would be pinning down the value of eta. Eta would have to be something like minus 0.018. If I want to draw a potential that corresponds to this picture, what would be happening is that, remember, epsilon is the first derivative, or rather it's square, and eta is the second derivative. I would have a situation where the second derivative was negative, but the first derivative was small. That would correspond to like a hilltop picture like this. This is sometimes called a hilltop model. The term you'll see a little more often is small field model, and I'll explain in a minute why that term is used. This would correspond to the a situation where the inflaton is very close to the top of a hill when the modes are crossing the horizon that form our current CMB. It must roll down the hill later. When the modes crossing the horizon are too small to be observed in our CMB, in order for inflation to end somewhere in this potential and for the inflaton to decay to standard model particles. Another scenario you could imagine is one where epsilon is large enough to be detected. So let's say detectable R, which is 16 epsilon. Then the deviation from scale invariance could be divided up in some more interesting way between the epsilon and eta terms. The current observational constraint on R puts some pressure on this scenario. If you take R to be at the 95% upper limit, setting the value of epsilon, then about one third of the deviation from scale invariance would come from the epsilon term, and two thirds would have to come from the eta term. Anyway, so for this picture, one category of models that would fall under this scenario, I'll call this a large field model, where the epsilon contribution to NS is non-negligible, would be a potential like M squared phi squared, which would have the property that for this potential epsilon and eta are equal. This specific potential M squared phi squared is actually ruled out by these constraints, but just as an example of the sort of model that would fall into this category. My sense is that maybe 10 years ago or so, there was a really large theory bias toward expecting this type of large field model. That doesn't seem to be what we're seeing in the data. What we're seeing in the data is more like this. The current constraint on R is not, I would say, not super constraining. If this upper limit improves by an order of magnitude in the near future without getting a detection, then we'd really be backed into a potential that kind of looks like this. You'll notice in textbooks on inflation that were written 10 years ago that there's some picture of V of phi at the beginning of the inflation chapter that will look like this. In the more modern books, the picture always looks like this. Another statement we can make about these two scenarios is that since the tensor to scalar ratio it's easier to use the quantity delta h squared, since that's h squared over m Planck squared, suppressing order one factors. So this type of scenario where sorry, I meant to write it over here. If R is detectable, so this corresponds to a scenario where the gravitational wave amplitude is greater than something like 10 to the minus 11 is I think probably sort of a realistic place where we might end up. Since that's h squared over m Planck squared, multiplied by some order one factors, this is the same thing as a model of inflation where the Hubble expansion rate is larger than, let's say, something like a few times 10 to the minus 5 m Planck's. Equivalently, some number like a few times 10 to the 13 GeV. This type of scenario where epsilon is very small would correspond to one where the inflationary Hubble is much less than that energy scale. So that's one way of thinking about the distinction between these two cases, is that the detection or non-detection of gravitational waves is telling you whether the energy scale of inflation or the Hubble rate is above some threshold. A way of parameterizing this that I actually like a little bit better is to instead of using the inflationary Hubble, to use the define the energy scale of inflation to be rho to the 1/4. Since I only have a minute left, I'll say that if you wanted to express this in terms of our observables, then you could write rho this way using Friedmann's equation, and then write H in terms of the observed gravitational wave amplitude R, to write it as something like fourth part on the fourth, which is 16 to 8. So a detectable R. Corresponds to an inflationary energy scale above 10 to the 16 GeV or so, which is roughly the grand unification scale, or gut scale. It's almost the same statement that we were making before, where detectable R corresponded to a Hubble above some threshold. Here I just chose to use a different parameter, the energy scale of inflation, which turns out to be Hubble to the 1/2 times M Planck to the 1/2. One unfortunate aspect of single field Sorolle inflation is that because R appears here raised to the 1/4 power, then a big improvement on a big observational improvement on R corresponds to a pretty small change in the inflationary scale. So there's a relatively narrow range of inflationary energy scales which are allowed by the current constraints and which we may rule out in the future. Final comment. Yeah, maybe one way of summarizing these previous results is that if we ever detect gravity waves, then we immediately pin down, or cosmological gravitational waves from inflation, then we immediately pin down energy scales. We pin down the energy scale of inflation to be somewhere near the gut scale, and Hubble during inflation to be something around 10 to the 13 GeV. But there's a lot of room for those energy scales to be much less than that. Like the largest energy scale in physics that we have direct constraints on is, you know, something like of order 10 TeV. And so if those scales are anywhere in between, then we would not see gravitational waves, and we would be in a hilltop bottle type scenario. The last comment that I'll make is that another thing that's true is this, is that the inflaton field excursion or the I'll write this as the change in the inflaton field value per factor of E in the expansion, the derivative with respect to log A. Is I didn't write this down anywhere in my notes. I'm going to compute this in slow roll. So the derivative, let me write that as dt times log a dt to the -1. This is h to the -1. And then phi dot I had somewhere as being 2 epsilon to the 1/2 times h m Planck. So this is 2 epsilon to the 1/2 times M Planck. In this step, I use the slow roll approximation. So another way of thinking about the difference between large field and slow field models is that if gravitational waves are detectable, That means that epsilon can't be too small, which implies in turn that the field excursion of the inflaton is of order M Planck. It's M Planck times some number, which is not too small. On the other hand, if epsilon is undetectably small, it could be many orders of magnitude below the current upper limits, then the field excursion of the inflaton, the amount that phi changes as our CMB fluctuations are generated, could be much smaller than M Planck. That's why I just wanted to explain why these two categories of models were called small field and large field models. Detectable R means that the field excursion is must be of order M Planck. This statement is sometimes called the Lyth bound, where I don't know why it's called a bound. I would the word bound suggests that it should be an inequality, but there's no inequality here. They're just equal to each other. There's a lot more I could say about inflation, but I have minus 5 minutes left, so I guess I'll start here. I'll say that right now, the observational constraints seem to be consistent with some version of single real field slow roll inflation. There are lots of models of the early universe that I didn't get a chance to talk about, but this is one simple possibility that's consistent with the data. We seem to be sort of backed into a corner where these scalar perturbations have been measured really well. We're not seeing the gravitational waves. We're just seeing improving upper limits that are sort of backing us into this corridor where the inflaton starts near the top of its potential. The energy scales of inflation are below some natural thresholds. H is below some natural threshold, and the energy density is below some gut scale natural threshold. I'll have to stop here. Thanks, everyone. Are there before we go? Are there any questions that anyone would like to ask?
Is the picture gonna change drastically if we assume massive inflaton? Are we gonna have a contribution to the potentially to the NS index or something like this?
Oh yeah, you can think of giving the inflaton mass as just adding an M squared pi squared term to the potential.